Meg was a freshman in high school and a brilliant mathematician. She had a little brother who was, if it was possible, even more brilliant than she was. And he was brilliant not just in the ways an IQ can measure, but at loving people. His name was Charles Wallace. Unfortunately for him, this combination didn't go so well in his elementary school classroom. Kids thought he was weird, and his teachers didn't know how to keep up with him. Meg was determined to prevent Charles Wallace from enduring the same fate of bullying she had lived through as a little kid by confronting her old principal and nemesis, in whose office she had spent far too much unjustified time, Mr. Jenkins. This is a synopsis of the beginning of Madeline Lengel's famous novel, A Wind in the Door, from the Wrinkle in Time series. As the story unfolds, the fate of not only Meg's little brother, Charles Wallace, but the whole of cosmic harmony will come to depend on Meg's ability to love her enemy, Mr. Jenkins. But as Meg explains to the cherubim angel who has come to Earth to help her on this adventure, if you mean you think I have to love Mr. Jenkins, you've got another thing coming. Meg snapped. That's the descriptor. She snapped this. I had one of those weeks when I opened up the lectionary, read that this was our text, and snapped at God in much the same way Meg snapped at the angel. And that's because we live in a world where evil is everywhere. News breaking about more and more sexual abuse in the Catholic Church. Financial greed of a few causing poverty that allowed a murderous fire to tear through homes in Bangladesh. The continued separation of children from their parents at our nation's border. The brutal politicization of access to health care. And that's just a few of the national headlines. Evil is real. And yet, Jesus tells us to love our enemies. What does that mean? Surely, like Meg standing up for her little brother, we are still supposed to demand that the powers that be act justly and care for those who are vulnerable. I don't think Jesus is telling us that loving our enemies means abdicating our power to demand justice from them. Justice is what love looks like in public, as Cornel West has said. It turns out there's a whole line of biblical scholarship looking at this particular text as a kind of nonviolent resistance text. It's pretty cool stuff, and I'm going to just give you a tiny synopsis of a part of it that's just about that line about the coat, giving up your coat. It's likely that someone asks for your coat in Jesus' time in repayment for a debt. It's not like a winter coat drive. You owe your oppressor something, and since you have no land and very little money, your oppressor asks for your very coat. Now, there were very clear restrictions regarding the repayment of debts. You couldn't leave a debtor naked at sundown, no matter how much he or she owed. It simply was not to be done. And it was against every sense of decency and good order. It was flat out humiliating to the person who you owed the debt to. So Jesus sets up another strategy of resistance. If they ask for your coat, give them your shirt too. There, you'll be standing half naked. They'll be forced to deal with this reality you've set up. No, 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 they'll say. I don't want your shirt, put it back on. They might be so disarmed that they'll return your coat as well. In other words, this text, in the thinking of Walter Wink, who's the one who pioneered this way of thinking about this text, is a kind of direct action tactic that demands dignity from the powers that be. And yet, today, as much as I love a creative direct action strategy, I need something more. In a world where evil isn't always so obvious or direct, in a world where evil sometimes looks like denial or complicity or just willful ignorance, I need more strategies, more tactics of love. Let's go back to Meg. How does Meg go from recognizing Mr. Jenkins' abuse of power and willful ignorance to hating him and deeming him her enemy? How does that move serve her? In other words, how do we go from recognizing evil to creating enemies? And frankly, why do we feel so much better when we do that? Sometimes, at least, if we're honest. Mary Hess is a local Lutheran scholar, and she explains the function of enemies this way. Psychologists note that identity is more easily sustained when there are clear external factors, enemies, that build limiting boundaries. Sociologists explain that the creation of and defense against enemies creates social cohesion and strengthens our collective identity. Anthropologists describe rituals that use emotions such as disgust and awe to strengthen specific taboos and affirm that which is human and that which is not, the latter all too quickly becoming the enemy. Cognitive scientists hypothesize that we remember with greater clarity and detail experiences that occur while the brain is flooded with adrenaline. Thus, experiences in the presence of an enemy might have especially sharp outlines that stay with us longer. But theologians caution that the process of creating identity in the presence of an enemy leads us all too often to defining that other in less than human terms, creating an object that we now have permission to hate. So, it seems we have a choice when faced with evil, with mistreatment, curses, and hate. We can either turn the person in whom we see evil working into an enemy, or we can love them. It usually feels a hell of a lot better in the immediate to turn them into an enemy. But that's only temporary. What is this love Jesus is talking about that's the alternative? And why is it worth it? This isn't romantic love. This isn't feeling love. This is God love, agape love in the Greek. This is the kind of love that asks us to see somebody as God sees them, as mere but also majestic humans. Meg's angel friend describes this kind of love as naming love. The angel's whole job is being what he calls a namer. What does a namer do? Asked Meg of the cherubim angel namer. The wings drew together, the eyes closed, small puffs of mist-like smoke rose and swirled about him. When I was memorizing the names of the stars, part of the purpose was to help them each to be more particularly the particular star each one was supposed to be. That's basically a namer's job. Maybe you're supposed to make earthlings feel more human, Meg. God love, naming in this way, isn't about imposing a name from the outside, but helping somebody, like a star of this angel's case, recognize who they already are. It's not about naming from the outside, but helping somebody recognize who they already are. The Bible, especially the stories of Genesis, are filled with this kind of story of naming. We could look at the whole of the creation story as a story of naming, of all of the elements of the earth coming together to be who they truly are as God names them. And then there are the stories of our ancestors in faith, Sarai and Abram, or as we know them now, Sarah and Abraham, because that is the name they received after encountering God's love. And then there's a story of Jacob wrestling a blessing out of an angel and God renaming him Israel. In each of these stories, the people look in the mirror that is God to see who they are. Instead of creating enemies, they look in the mirror that is God. And that's another way of organizing ourselves and recognizing ourselves collectively and individually. But how do I do it? How do I name Mr. Jenkins when all I think of when I see him hits out is how awful he is? Asked Meg. The cherubim angel sighed and flung several wings heavenward so violently that he lifted several feet, materialized, and came down with a thud. There's a word, but if I say it, you'll just misunderstand. You have to say it. It's a four-letter word. Aren't four-letter words considered bad ones on your planet? Come on, I've seen all the four-letter words on the walls of the washroom at school. Okay, love. What? Love. That's what makes persons know who they are. You're full of love, Meg, but you don't know how to stay within it when it's not easy. What do you mean? Oh, well, you love your family. That's easy. Not for all of us. Sometimes, when you feel awful about somebody, you get back into rightness by thinking about, well, you seem to be telling me that you get back into love by thinking about your little brother, Charles Wallace. This is the secret of loving those who profess to hate you, curse you, and mistreat you, instead of turning them into enemies. In order to love like this, you have to remember that you are loved. And not just loved on your best day, but loved on your very worst day when you are your very worst self. For Meg, the person who she knows loves her like this is her little brother, Charles Wallace. When she can remember what it is like to be loved by Charles Wallace, she can look at Mr. Jenkins differently. She can claim her power of being loved to see that Mr. Jenkins' vulnerability somehow got all twisted and tangled up in the form of a bully. In other words, she can see him from God's perspective and reflect a version of him back towards him that he might receive. This is naming in the language of Madeline Lengel. This is love in the language of the Bible. It's a mutual process. One does not name another. One does not love another unidirectionally. Sarah, Abraham, and Jacob, and all the heroes of our biblical stories do the spiritual work of receiving love, too. The stars work with the angel namer to remember who they are. Meg, naming Mr. Jenkins is just the beginning of Mr. Jenkins' next chapter of his life. He goes on to confess his wrongdoing, to lean on the angels and learn where he once upon a time got stuck and hurt, and repair the damage he inflicted with his power as the principal. And also important to note, Meg didn't love Mr. Jenkins alone, or non-consensually, or in a way that would hurt her. I say this explicitly because this scripture text has been used by some to advise people to stay in abusive relationships. And I want to be really, 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 really clear that that's not my message. Meg took every step of her journey towards loving Mr. Jenkins as her own choice, accompanied by a community of angels and teachers who protected her while she did the incredibly vulnerable work of loving as God loves. This is how we too are to love our enemies. We remember that we are beloved first and foremost by looking in the mirror that is God. And sometimes that means looking at ourselves through the eyes of our own Charles Wallaces. And from that position of power in belovedness, we are able to see the vulnerability of a person acting out evil, mistreating, cursing, or hating us. In doing so, we become a kind of God mirror to them, challenging them to be who they truly are. We never do it alone or in ways that harm us. Like Meg, we take every step of compassion, accompanied by our own communities of angels and teachers. We take every step together so that we can together recognize the God who dwells within each of us. This blessing takes one look at you, and all it can say is holy. Holy hands, holy face, holy feet, holy everything in between. Holy even in pain. Holy even when weary. In brokenness, holy. In shame, holy still. So, friend, open your eyes, holy eyes. For one moment, see what this blessing sees. This blessing that knows how you have been formed and knit together in wonder and love. Welcome this blessing that folds its hands in prayer when it meets you. Receive this blessing that wants to kneel in reverence before you. You who are temple, sanctuary, home for God in this world.